This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is Damon Root, a longtime legal affairs writer, constitutional scholar for Reason Magazine. He's worked elsewhere as well at the Columbia House Record catalog.
CD to the month, 12 CDs for a penny.
Yeah.
Can't beat it.
Well, we'll talk mostly about that, but we'll also squeeze in a little bit about conversation about his latest book, Emancipation War, The Fall of Slavery and the Coming of the 13th Amendment. Damon, thanks for talking to
Reason. Thank you, Nick. Great to be here.
Okay, Emancipation War is about the 13th Amendment, which bans slavery in the United States and all of its territories. You start off writing the book early in 1861, and it's Abraham Lincoln is talking about how, yeah, he's for the 13th Amendment, but the 13th Amendment he's talking about would preserve slavery, and or it would say the federal government has no ability to change slavery status. You know, what's going on? Set the stage.
This is this sort of forgotten or maybe misremembered part of the first inaugural address, where Lincoln endorses this constitutional amendment that has just passed Congress, and it says that the federal government can never touch slavery in the states. It would be illegal to, be unconstitutional to amend the Constitution to go after slavery in the states. And that is sort of this gesture of trying to prevent the Civil War, trying to keep the country from falling apart over the issue of slavery. And so if that had been ratified by the states, that would be the 13th Amendment in our Constitution. But instead, a couple years later, 1864, Lincoln endorses another constitutional amendment. This is the one we know today, to abolish slavery everywhere.
So this, and then that starts the Reconstruction Amendments.
Correct.
That kind of actually bring African Americans and foreigners, apparently, anchor babies into American citizenship rights and things like that.
Well, we could talk about the 14th Amendment for sure.
The amendment had passed Congress, but it had not gone to the states, and the southern states started to secede, right? Is that why it was never voted on?
Right. It never goes through that state ratification process. Yeah. And so then when the real 13th Amendment, the final 13th Amendment, comes up in Congress, one of the first things that Congress has to do is have an official repeal of this earlier one. And so various senators and Congress people who had voted for that said, well, you know, I would have been willing to do anything to prevent the outbreak of war a couple years ago, but right. Now the war is upon us, and the way to bring it to a conclusion is to have this anti-slavery amendment. And so the cause of the Union and the cause of emancipating slaves become intertwined.
Before we start talking about the 13th Amendment and kind of the one that gets adopted and the people behind it and whatnot, Lincoln represents a fascinating, you know, character, particularly, I mean, he's like the ultimate, you know, he is the most important president probably, right? Or, I mean, people will argue he's certainly one of the most written about. In libertarian circles, Lincoln tends to be equated with the old Edmund Wilson argument that he was American Caesar, that he was a tyrant and a despot who hated black people and was not interested in, you know, in ending slavery or anything. Can you talk a little bit about how this moment kind of gives a certain amount of evidence to a harsh, negative, kind of pragmatic, utilitarian, morally craven Lincoln?
Well, he is anti-slavery, but he's not an abolitionist. Right. So at the start of the war, and he also has a belief, and it's shared by many, that the federal government would not have the power to ban slavery in the states, even if it wanted to, and was limited in what it can do. But then, as the war goes on, and questions of military necessity, and eventually we get the Emancipation Proclamation, and other things come out of that. So Lincoln is, he is not a radical abolitionist at the start of the war by any means. And so one of the things that I was interested in this book is, how do we get from Lincoln of 1861 to Lincoln of 1864, where he changes his mind so much? And so one of my arguments is to look at all of the forces acting upon him and the anti-slavery movement, the real radical abolitionists, who are people like Frederick Douglass and Charles Sumner and Selma P. Chase, who's in Lincoln's cabinet, who are arguing for varying degrees of quite radical anti-slavery action, whether it's abolishing slavery through, you know, military necessity, whether it's, you know, Frederick Douglass has this argument that the Constitution's a glorious liberty document, that you can just use the text of the Constitution and just go after slavery everywhere without a constitutional amendment.
And that, I mean, you've written a book about Frederick Douglass and that kind of those sets of arguments.
Right. I mean, there's kind of three views of the Constitution and slavery mm-hmm. that are all kind of jostling together in the 1850s. One is the pro-slavery view. The Constitution is a pro-slavery document. It protects slavery everywhere. And obviously, this is the view of Jefferson Davis, people like that. It's also the view of the radical abolitionist, William Lloyd Garrison, who burns the Constitution, says it's a covenant with death, an agreement with hell. So that's kind of one view. The Constitution's entirely pro-slavery. Frederick Douglass comes to this view that the Constitution is actually entirely anti-slavery. Mm-hmm. And then there is this other position which becomes associated with all of the anti-slavery political parties, so the Liberty Party, right. but then especially the Free Soil Party, and then the Republican Party, which is this idea of freedom national, slavery local. So freedom is national. Slavery is a creature of local law only, which means that the federal government can go after slavery everywhere that's within the authority of the federal government. So you can ban slavery in Washington, D.C. You can outlaw the interstate slave trade. And then most importantly of all, the big issue of the 1850s is the federal territories, that Congress can prohibit slavery in the federal territories. Because if no new slave states form and enter the Union, then slavery is sort of limited to that hardcore in what becomes the Confederacy.
And the idea with that is it will eventually die out because it's just going to be overwhelmed by too many free states.
It would be sort of surrounded. That's, yeah. That's one of the arguments there. And then, so then the pro-slavery side has this opposite yeah. view that the federal government actually, has to protect slavery mm-hmm. in the territories. So this idea of Lincoln is the centralizer, and there's something to that. But then you look at these debates in the 1850s, Jefferson Davis, all of these people who are sometimes lauded as these kind of localists, they're adopting this centralizing view of federal power. It's just a pro-slavery centralization. So you have competing views. Both of them say the federal government can do this big thing. But the question is it going to be to stop slavery from taking root in the territory, or is it going to be to, that slavery has to be protected everywhere where the flag floats? And you see this in the debates over the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854. So this is Stephen Douglas, the senator from Illinois.
The little giant,
that's right. And he comes up with this idea of popular sovereignty. Well, just let the settlers of these territories decide, and it'll be pro-slavery, it'll be anti-slavery, depending on, that's a truly kind of local solution, you might say. And Jefferson Davis and the kind of the pro-slavery people, they go crazy over this. This is squatter sovereignty. This trashes the Constitution. I mean, this is this thing that absolutely is an inciting kind of idea for the secessionists,
which also leads to problems when the Democrats run against Lincoln, because they've got Northern Democrats and Southern Democrats.
Right,
or Union Democrats, I guess.
That's right. So there's, the election of 1860. I mean, there's multiple candidates winning different sections of the country, and it sort of, that's the split. That's the beginning. So this idea that that Congress can ban slavery in the federal territories, it's so important. And so the first chapter of this book is basically about all these fights over that in the 1850s. It's the kind of the lead up. We kind of forget that the Dred Scott case is a big part of that, is because Dred Scott is taken by his enslaver mm-hmm. to free territory, and that's part of his argument. He's like, well, Dr. John Emerson brought me to free territory, therefore I've earned my freedom. This once free, forever free doctrine. And the Supreme Court says, no, that's not true, because Congress never had the power to outlaw slavery in the federal territory. So the Compromise of 1850 is unconstitutional. The Missouri Compromise is unconstitutional. And by the way, the kind of the platform of the Republican Party is essentially unconstitutional, the freedom national idea.
You talk about how in the Northwest Ordinance that kind of laid out what was then the frontier in the Western Reserve, mostly became Ohio and Indiana. That was passed in the 1780s or 1790s?
The Northwest Ordinance is first passed by the Continental Congress,
right.
then repassed by the first Congress signed by George Washington, and that outlaws slavery in the federal territories.
Yeah, and so, this argument, and I mean, Jefferson Davis, if you're a Jefferson Davis fan, you're not going to love this book. All 10 of you, but it's, it is absolutely a bad faith argument, isn't it, that there was no precedent for kind of banning slavery in territories or other parts of the United States?
There is precedent for it. The Northwest Ordinance is this precedent. It's just this sort of historical fact that Jefferson Davis and others try to kind of argue their way around, I think unpersuasively. Certainly, as a sort of legal historical argument, it's very poor. But you know what Davis would say is that, well, you know, if when these states all formed together, the slave states, if they thought that they were giving Congress the power to deprive them their ability to take slaves anywhere with them, they never would have joined the Union in the first place. Which is this is kind of this reasoning backwards right. to the conclusion he wants. It's not,
but,
you know,
but it sounds plausible too, right?
It's a plausible. You know, and to, if you're trying, you're saying I'm trying to read the minds of these people and what they would do, and like maybe that's the case. But as a sort of like a matter of constitutional history, this precedent is there, and it becomes, and so then the Northwest Ordinance, that language becomes this rallying cry for the anti-slavery movement, and it's ultimately adopted in the 13th Amendment.
Yeah.
You know, modified a little bit, but that's it.
You know, how did popular sovereignty work out?
Well, there was a little bit of blood was shed, mm-hmm. Bleeding Kansas. This is what part of the reason why John Brown is famous. So essentially, you have sort of guerrilla warfare between right. pro-slavery and anti-slavery separatists.
And it's kind of like, okay, the vote is coming at a certain time, so both, you know, pro-slavery, anti-slavery forces are sending people to live there and to intimidate the other side.
Right. So there's historians will say that's, you know, the first blood that's shed in the Civil mm-hmm. War is shed in, you know, in Kansas, yeah. whether it's the pro-slavery settlers murdering mm-hmm. abolitionists. I mean, there was deaths earlier, of course. There's yeah. abolitionists who were murdered, you know, mm-hmm. before that. But that kind of almost guerrilla warfare that, mm-hmm. that breaks out. None of these things settle this debate.
Right.
You know,
the people, you know, like Frederick Douglass, who say, well, you know, the Constitution obviously doesn't sanction slavery because, you know, there's no mention of it, et cetera. Is that, I mean, it's a very clever argument, but it also seems as a kind of historical reality. It just doesn't seem true. I mean, I want it to be true, but
it works as a, if you want to call it a very kind of textualist argument. And that's what Douglass says. And he gets this idea from this guy, Lysander Spooner, who's
right.
this famous
mm-hmm.
kind of anarchist legal theorist. And his book,
I prefer to think of him as the guy who showed that private mail delivery.
That's right. He tried.
Could work. Yeah.
He tried. But so he has this book, The Unconstitutionality of Slavery. And he, you know, he basically, essentially, like the way we would make his argument today would be, you know, if the Martians came down and they just looked at the text of the document mm-hmm. without all of the conversation and debates and discourse and everything else, if they just looked at it, they would say, oh, well, it's full of all these liberty-minded principles. There's no, you know, slavery's not mentioned anywhere in it. Certainly as a historical argument, you know, I mean, that slavery is discussed in the Federalist Papers, you know, it's like that. So, and the way that certainly we talk about these things nowadays, whether it's like originalism or something right. like that, the Frederick Douglass argument doesn't win.
Yeah, what did he do with, like, you know, the counting of three-fifths of other people, you know?
Well, again, the word person can be open to different interpretations. And so if there's this kind of competing interpretation, the interpretation that would advance freedom rather than restrict freedom is the one that should be adopted. It's
right.
it's sort of arguments, arguments like that, basically.
Yeah. The other, you know, the other argument kicking around, or the idea that the Constitution, you could write a constitutional amendment that would say, and this, what this amendment is about can never change. Does that make any sense, or is that kind of laughable on its face? The idea that we're going to pass an amendment to the Constitution that says slavery can never be amended out of the Constitution.
Well, you know, that's interesting. It was an attempt at a compromise measure. There's nothing in the Constitution that sort of speaks to what the quality of the amendment.
Yeah.
You know, that says this is the amendment process. You got to do this, this, and this, and then you have an amendment. So I suppose that
Had any amendments been repealed? I mean, what amendments have been repealed? Just the prohibition?
Has been overwritten, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so like nobody really knew what kind of makes sense.
I guess that's right.
Discuss Salmon Chase. And, you know, this is funny because in reading this, and I think like a lot of people, I've been reading, you know, a fair amount of history because it's the 250th anniversary of the Declaration and whatnot. And like a lot of the people in this book, like I feel like I know more about them, but I have kind of forgotten a little bit. But Salmon Chase.
Well, he's one of the great anti-slavery figures. He's a lawyer from Ohio, and he helps to found the Liberty Party, the Free Soil Party. He's the most important kind of theorist behind that Freedom National anti-slavery constitutional idea I was talking about. He runs for president in 1860. Also, Lincoln wins. So he joins Lincoln's cabinet as Secretary of the Treasury. And then as a kind of the capstone of his career, he's appointed Chief Justice of the United States. And he replaces Roger Taney, who's the author of the Dred Scott decision. And in his younger days, Chase had defended fugitive slaves as well as people who'd helped them escape and brought some
and
of those cases.
And there was a lot. He's from Cincinnati.
He's from
in
Cincinnati.
Ohio. So there's a lot that the Ohio River was the border of slave states and free states.
He talks about how this sort of pro-slavery mob that was going after the abolitionists and destroying the printing presses and terrorizing abolitionist journalists and speakers in Cincinnati kind of radicalized him into anti-slavery. Yeah. And that was kind of the start. That he'd been against slavery before, but hadn't really had a strong position. Then after that, he saw it was an attack on free speech, on freedom of the person, on liberty kind of in all of its forms. And that launches him into it. So he's this extremely important legal constitutional theorist in the anti-slavery movement.
Yeah. Is there enough bad things to say about Taney? Not only in the Dred Scott decision, but he, you know, in articulating the idea that there are no rights, you know, that a black has that a white should need to take care of. He's like reading in a substantive due process understanding of the Constitution, right? Where it just that. But what was he like on other issues? Was he constantly terrible, or?
Well, yeah, he has not gone down well, you know, in history for Dred Scott and for others. He was a quite staunch defender of slavery, kind of, you know, across the board. I'm not sure there's great things to say about him. In terms of the Dred Scott decision, I mean, one of the things that in real time, the dissents in that case point out how his argument just is sort of factually wrong. He says that, you know, when the United States was founded, African Americans were no part of We the People. And so they still can't be. So black people cannot be citizens, cannot be U.S. citizens, and never can be. And so therefore, Dred Scott has no standing to sue in federal court. That's kind of how it plays into the case. But as Justice Curtis and Justice McLean both point out in their dissents, well, you know, there were in a number of northern states, there were African Americans who qualified as voters, were voters. Therefore, they were part of the We the People that actually participated in the ratification of the Constitution. So to say that someone who would help bring the document into existence was not part of that as sort of this kind of, you know, legal malfeasance, but yet that's the majority holding.
When did he die, Taney?
He dies in 64. 63, yeah. 60, I think it's 64.
Did he know that, like, the Civil War was going to end with a Union victory?
He may not have known how it was going to end.
Because he's originally from Maryland.
Yes.
Right?
He's, yeah. This is one of the things, this is sort of important to the Lincoln administration during the war, is that you have in 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation goes into effect. And so this is a military measure to emancipate enslaved persons in states that are in rebellion. And there is a question in the back of Lincoln's mind and the back of others' minds is, well, if this comes before the Supreme Court somehow, and there's Taney sitting there as Chief Justice of the United States, is he going to strike this down? Are we going to, you know, is it on some kind of shaky legal foundations,
right,
even if they believed in it, but maybe the Supreme Court won't. And so he's kind of hovering as this, you know, this evil spirit over that.
Talk a bit about, you know, before Lincoln, and I want to talk about his Emancipation Proclamation that goes into effect, but he had a couple of generals who emancipated slaves in parts of the country that were in rebellion to the Union. And he was like, hey, you don't do that.
Yeah, when I was talking earlier about the sort of forces acting on Lincoln, acting on the federal government, pushing in an anti-slavery direction, the role of these abolitionist generals is very important. So General Fremont, he's the first one to do it, the Pathfinder.
And he's the first Republican candidate for president.
In 1856, he's the first Republican candidate. And he, as a military necessity, he issues an limited emancipation proclamation in the military department under his control. And Lincoln overturns it, says, you know, we can't do that. He's worried about the border states. He's worried about people who are slaveholding but are still loyal to the Union, and publicly overturns it. The anti-slavery movement is, you know, outraged by this, you know, chastises Lincoln. And then General David Hunter, who's got the Department of the South, which is basically South Carolina, that kind of South Carolina, Florida, that area. He does the same thing, issues his own wartime, issues his own Emancipation Proclamation. And Hunter and Lincoln are friends. And Lincoln once again publicly rebukes him, overturns it. But then in this letter, he said, in his statement overturning this, says, well, you know, the question of whether the executive may free slaves as a military necessity is one that I, you know, reserve to myself as president, which is that he's at this point, he's now starting to think about the Emancipation Proclamation. There's this, you know, the war has taken these turns. Mm-hmm. You've got these generals doing these things. Of course, you've got the role of and, I mean, enslaved people themselves are a big part of this because the war breaks out and they're coming to Union lines. They are making demands, saying this is a war for freedom. As far as we're concerned, we're here. This puts pressure on the federal government. What's the policy going to be? All of these sort of things are all, you know, these are all in play. They're all happening. And that's kind of driving Lincoln in the direction he ultimately goes.
Talk about Lazarus Powell from Kentucky. If you admit the principle contended for by the gentlemen who urged this amendment, logic would lead them to the conclusion that the general government could, by an amendment to its constitution, regulate every domestic matter in the states. So he's basically making an argument that if the government can ban slavery, it can do anything it wants.
Right. Right. That is an argument that's part of the debates about the 13th Amendment. Mm-hmm. It becomes a part of the debate about the 14th Amendment. One of the questions coming out of the Civil War is that, you know, slavery is abolished by constitutional amendment, but then you have the former Confederate states are still trying to bring slavery back by other means. There's foot dragging, and so what's the role? You know, what's the role of Congress? What can Congress do or not do under what powers? Mm-hmm. And so that's arguments that are raised against the 13th Amendment, but then kind of continue to be part of the debate.
Hey, Reason Interview listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme, Reason and Love, explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Alexis de Tocqueville in small dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't sit through lectures, they practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students explore Chicago's cultural landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, and that includes room for the full week with scholarships available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. Is there a particular moment when Lincoln, you know, kind of says, oh, okay, you know, I started at the start of the war, I was in favor of a 13th Amendment that would preserve slavery because I want to maintain the Union. And then he knows by the end of the war, I have to support a 13th Amendment that would abolish slavery. Is there, it's obviously a lot of degrees, but what happens when that flip is switched with him?
Well, it's not all at once. You know, it's this series of events and stages. But by 1864, what he says is that, you know, this is something I quote in the book where he says, you know, I claim not to have controlled events, but claim that events have controlled me. That the different factors that are happening are pushing him in the direction. But he also says that he always hated slavery. Yeah. And
he attests to that in, you know, both public and private pronouncements.
Right. There's a point when he doesn't think it's within his powers to act in certain ways.
To go back to these kind of libertarian critiques of Lincoln, they're often like, oh, well, you know, he the Emancipation Proclamation only affected states that had seceded from the Union. So it's a really kind of hollow and cynical attempt to say, you know, what he could do. And Lincoln was, or, you know, like he was somehow, you know, just antithetical to abolition of slavery anywhere at any time. But he also then, you know, part of his argument, right, is that he can do it as commander in chief in like areas that have, you know, that are under military rule rather than normal rule.
Yeah, there's sort of two parts to that. I mean, one is that the border states are Lincoln is
and
desperate
are,
to keep.
These are slave owning states that stayed loyal to the Union.
Kentucky, so that's
Missouri,
Maryland,
Kentucky,
and yeah, Maryland. Places like that that are slaveholding states. They've stayed loyal to the Union, and Lincoln is desperate to keep them on the Union side. So they are exempted from the Emancipation Proclamation. So there's that part of it. But then there is the part of it that, yes, when it's a military necessity, the commander-in-chief can act in certain ways that in peacetime you couldn't normally do. And so those two ideas together. And then by the time we're talking about the 13th Amendment, the final 13th Amendment, then it's this question of if the war ends, what about the border states? What about places where slavery, you know, that hasn't been, if a border state hasn't taken action against slavery and the military necessity is over. So that's one of one of the things that's kind of pushing towards this constitutional amendment, as well as the question of what's the lasting role of the Emancipation Proclamation? The war ends. Does it still have effect? It doesn't, there's no longer hostilities. You no longer have a state or a municipality in rebellion. So how would you preserve the state of freedom that's been brought about?
Can you walk us through that? Like how does this play out as the Civil War ends and, you know, the post-Civil War era? I mean, we're not quite into Reconstruction, but we're edging into that. How does this play out?
Well, it plays out that the 13th Amendment, you know, is first introduced in Congress in 1864, passes in 1865. There's a couple of votes in the House before it finally passes. And then it goes to the states for ratification. There's a whole question of which state should ratify it. Charles Sumner, who's the abolitionist senator from Massachusetts, he says it should only be the states that stayed loyal. But Lincoln has pushed for it to be all of the states.
Right, and the argument there is that if it's only the states that stayed loyal, and you know it could win with free states voting for it, and then it's just going to complicate the idea that it's actually reflective of the entire United States.
That it would be a divisive, that it wouldn't be something that's like, so bring the country together. So it ends up being, so it takes longer to ratify the amendment. And so while that's happening is precisely at the time when these questions, now we're into this kind of Reconstruction amendments part of it, because so the 13th Amendment is out for ratification by the states. But then states like Mississippi and Louisiana start to enact these measures called the Black Codes, which are bringing vestiges of slavery back, or maybe they've never gone, restrictions on African Americans' right to own guns, to own property, to work in certain places, all of these, as well as, you know, you have like convict lease and sharecropping, you know, all of these kind of things that we associate with kind of the Jim Crow South are coming up. And so then that becomes the debate about the need for the 14th Amendment. To establish citizenship, to bring the states clearly under a kind of a federal control. So the 14th Amendment says that, you know, no state shall make or enforce any law which will abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor deny due process, nor deny equal protection of the laws. So then you have this authority of Congress as well as the federal courts. Mm-hmm. You have this kind of nationalizing of the Bill of Rights that happens through the 14th Amendment. And so that gets into all of these questions of like what's going on at the state and the local level immediately after the Civil War that would seem, you know, some of the people who voted and supported the 13th Amendment, they thought it took care of all of that. They said the 13th Amendment kind of authorizes Congress to ensure freedom throughout the country, and you should be able to if your freedom is being violated in, you know, Mississippi or wherever, you go to the federal courthouse and vindicate your rights. There was civil rights acts being passed, like 18 Civil Rights Act of 1866, but there's still this question, is that constitutional?
Right.
This kind of federalism debate.
Right.
And it goes back to these founding ideas of the Republican Party.
Can you explain, because this is kind of something, and again, it gets refracted through a libertarian lens in kind of odd ways, because you would assume, on one level, I think, you would assume no ideology is more anti-slavery than libertarianism. It seems to be predicated upon the idea that everybody owns themselves. And then you have, a weird but not insubstantial kind of sub-theme among libertarian historians and whatnot that Lincoln overreached. Or, things like Civil Rights Act, certainly from the 60s, overreached by saying that free association meant that you could ban blacks from restaurants and theaters and hotels and things like that, some of which were explicitly mentioned in these 19th century civil rights acts. So how do the Civil Rights Act pass right after the Civil War, which seemed to settle the matter, to say that everybody who is an American, every American citizen has, the ability to kind of go wherever they want to and kind of, shop wherever they want to, stay wherever they want to. How does that get vitiated?
Well, nowadays we think about the Bill of Rights and we say, well, if the city of New York or the state of New York or any the state of Maine or any sort of place violates your right to free speech or says, you can't have the handgun or any number of things, you'd say, oh, well, that violates the Bill of Rights. But the Bill of Rights, think about the First Amendment, it says Congress shall make no law. The Bill of Rights when it's originally passed, is a limit on the federal government alone. And the Supreme Court says that in 1833. So coming out of the Civil War, when we have the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which basically says that there's all of these rights that the freed people have, the right to own property, the right to make contracts, the right to sue in federal court, all these different sort of things that cannot be violated by the states. There's still this idea that, well, those are national rights, but they're not local rights. And so these kind of things don't bind the states. And so that's your impetus for the 14th Amendment. The Free Soil Party is founded on this kind of free labor ideology, the right of economic freedom, making contracts, all these sorts of things. And obviously slavery completely violates all of that. And then the kind of the proto Jim Crow South right after the Civil War violates all of that. But how do you go to federal court to vindicate those rights and say, well, my right to make a contract is being violated, something like that. So there's a Civil Rights Act of 1866, but even the authors of that question whether Congress has the constitutional authority to pass it. And so then the 14th Amendment is basically national, or basically constitutionalizes those civil rights laws.
You also talk about the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which seems to have done, most of the work of laws that had to be passed in the 1950s and 60s, but never really got taken seriously.
Well, it's struck down by the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
The so-called civil rights cases. Mm-hmm. And then I write about that a little bit in the book because the dissent in that case says that, this kind of violates the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment was in part about getting rid of not just slavery, but the phrase was the badges and incidents of slavery. So all of these kind of post-war, discriminatory laws that are being put in to, if not quite preserve slavery, but come close, they're violating the 13th Amendment. That's sort of part of one of the arguments in that case. And the Supreme Court, rules against, so strikes that down. The Supreme Court in 1873, the first time the 14th Amendment is heard by the Supreme Court in a matter called the Slaughterhouse Cases, basically extremely narrows the scope of the 14th Amendment, essentially kind of guts the privileges and immunities clause.
So it's kind of like you're a citizen and you're entitled to all of the stuff in America, but it doesn't mean like a state can't pass a law to say, well, you can't be an accountant or you can't ply a particular trade.
When you get into the economic realm, the states still have quite a bit of leeway to do that, because the Supreme Court, this is something that in kind of the long history of the Supreme Court, economic rights were protected more aggressively kind of around the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And then in kind of the progressive New Deal era, that there's a sort of a dialing back of that. Whereas the enumerated rights in the Bill of Rights have much more protection. So, you know, before the 14th Amendment, the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, all of these grand, you know, liberties and freedoms that we talk about, you know, none of those were binding on state governments. And since the 14th Amendment, and the Supreme Court kind of got around to doing this gradually through a series of cases, but as a result of the 14th Amendment, those are now all limits on the states. So, So many of the things that we, you know, because so much of the regulation that kind of happens in people's lives is actually happening at a state and local level, like most criminal law is state law.
So do you think the kind of expansion of those rights, is that overall a win for liberty, or is it a loss? Because it's saying, you know, the federal government really is kind of dictating terms more and more.
Well, I wouldn't call it federal government dictating terms. Okay. I mean, I think the idea that thanks to the 14th Amendment, my rights are being violated by a state or city, I can go to federal court and at least try to vindicate them. I think that's an expansion of liberty and an important advance. You know, sort of for the kind of the libertarian, you know, perspective, if you think about a case that libertarians were quite outraged about a few years ago, more than a few years ago now, the Kelo case, that's the eminent domain case. You know, if the 14th Amendment is an infringement on liberty, then it's fine that Suzette Kelo lost, because that was a local government saying, we're taking your land, and the Fifth Amendment's the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment really shouldn't stand in our way. And that's essentially what the Supreme Court said. And so if you think that her being able to go to federal court and fight for her Fifth Amendment right to have her home not be stolen, mm-hmm. Through eminent domain abuse, if that's a restriction on liberty, then the outcome of that case you should be happy about. And I think that libertarians generally see that as an injustice. And so you might want to think about, if that's an injustice, then your view of the 14th Amendment is, if you see it as this like restriction on liberty, right, somehow, or this shrinking of it, there's a tension there.
Mm-hmm. Let's come back to the 14th Amendment in a second, but to close out the discussion of the 13th Amendment and your book, The Emancipation War, The Fall of Slavery and the Coming of the 13th Amendment, what is the, you know, obviously, you know, there's an obvious significance of the 13th Amendment, you know, which is it abolishes involuntary servitude and slavery. What is the kind of long echo, or, you know, what is the pulse that it keeps pushing through American culture right now? Like, you know, how important and how vital is it to contemporary discussions of, you know, of kind of citizenship and of national identity and things like that?
Well, there's quite a bit about citizenship being debated and discussed now, right, certainly. So it lives on in that way. 13th and 14th Amendments are both this response to the Dred Scott decision, which takes a very narrow view of U.S. citizenship. So it lives on in that way. There's also an interesting kind of critical view of the 13th Amendment that's emerged in the last sort of few decades, that says it abolishes slavery, but then by allowing involuntary servitude, if you're convicted of a crime, then that was this kind of supercharging for what happened in Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. And I address that a little bit in the book, because I think that the involuntary servitude part of it, that's something that had been around since the founding. So the 13th Amendment doesn't expand that. That's something that kind of already existed, and that already would have been a part, would have been something people were fighting over in Jim Crow if the 13th Amendment had been worded differently. But it still is something that, you know, we're still kind of arguing about that part of it. And then just this bigger question of slavery in the Constitution is something that is a perennial argument that we have. And so, to go back to that kind of Frederick Douglass idea, mm-hmm. how much liberty is there in the Constitution that it required this amendment? Does that demean it somehow? You know, these kind of things. So it's, I think that's still well, alive.
And can you talk a little bit about, you, at the very close of the book, you talk about how some critics of the 13th Amendment, or a critical reading of the 13th Amendment and the ability to do involuntary servitude for, you know, people who are found guilty of crimes, or, you know, there's a couple of other situations that, you know, that explains the failure of Reconstruction. Can you talk a little bit about the Reconstruction period? And what kind of shadow that casts on America? Because this is, you know, I mean, it's kind of fascinating. The Reconstruction period, like, seems to mostly be a black hole for, like, a lot of people who talk about America, you know, and they love American history, and people love it right up until about Appomattox, and then it kicks into gear sometime in the late 1890s, and that, you know, obviously Jim Crow is, you know, formally instantiated with Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, right? But, you know, the Reconstruction era kind of gets overlooked.
When I was, a few years ago, when I was writing my book about Frederick Douglass, I wrote a chapter on the Reconstruction years.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, at that point, it had been this kind of story of struggle,
mm-hmm.
triumph, you know, slavery's abolished. And then there's this chapter that's quite a, it's kind of quite depressing, because, you know, there's this call to, well, the, you know, the American Anti-Slavery Society should just disband because slavery's ended. We have a 13th Amendment. You know, we're not needed anymore. And Frederick Douglass says, oh, of course, we're still needed. I mean, it's the fight is hardly over. And then he spends, you know, the next several decades fighting for what becomes the 15th Amendment, the right to vote, fighting against the rise of lynching and these sorts of sort of, you know, horrible injustices that are going on. So it's this period that where there's Eric Foner has this book about Reconstruction. He calls it America's Unfinished Revolution. I think that's what the subtitle is.
You not only worked at Columbia House Record Catalog, but you went to Columbia University where Foner is, right?
He's a huge presence.
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of the premier historian of Reconstruction America, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. Yes. And so there is this idea of what could have been, that there was, you know, there's a great book about all this called The Strange Career of Jim Crow, also C. Van Woodward's book, which looks at that this kind of Reconstruction, these kind of series of failures that happen and the loss of liberty that kind of by the time we get to, you know, the 1890s and the early 20th century, just how bad things have gotten, it's a series of different things that bring that about. And there's actually quite a bit of promise early on. You know, it's a kind of a complicated, you know, story, because there's one of the things I write about in the book is the role of this U.S. Supreme Court in kind of subverting Reconstruction through as I mentioned, the Slaughterhouse cases, which got the 14th Amendment, the Civil Rights cases, which got the Civil Rights Act of 1875. And all of those are these kind of steps to Plessy v. Ferguson, which is the separate but equal case. And so certainly the federal courts are really do, you know, do tremendous damage themselves.
Do you, and this will lead into a discussion, you know, we're talking at the very end of May, this is going up in early June, it'll be before the birthright citizenship case that the Supreme Court is hearing, or it's deciding this term, is out almost certainly, and I'm going to ask you about that in a second, but do you think overall is the Supreme Court the major force that kind of pushes things forward or backwards through its decisions, or is it mostly reflective of where America is?
Well, I think the unsatisfying answer is it depends mm-hmm. on the era. Mm-hmm. So something like, you know, the Dred Scott case, Chief Justice Taney, he really thought he was settling the slavery question. This is gonna settle it. And so you could say that he got ahead of the country, but in the wrong direction, or certainly in this extremely divisive issue. And he thought he was just going to kind of put the gavel down, and that would be that. And so I wouldn't say he was following some public opinion, but not all of it. There's this burgeoning anti-slavery sentiment that's coming up.
And that, you know, I think they were like American Heritage illustrated books of the U.S. presidents or something as a kid that you would buy at the supermarket. But I remember looking at the electoral map of 1860, you know, where it's like four different candidates, I think four or five candidates got electoral votes. So you saw whatever the country was breaking apart over relationship to both, you know, how important is staying in the Union and of America, and how much slavery like kind of broke apart even the Democratic Party, which was, you know, more pro-slavery than the Republicans. You know, let's talk about the Supreme. You know, the question was: is Supreme Court, you know, is it a leading indicator or a lagging indicator of kind of like where the country is going?
Yeah, I think I would take it maybe on a case by case basis. I do think there is a times when it's a lagging indicator. You know, there's probably just a function of, you know, the justices who come out of like a law school, legal, political culture of a certain time, and then they are on the bench for, you know, five or six centuries, you know, I think at this point. Can be lagging, you know, for those reasons.
That clearly happened in the early part of the 20th century, where you have these guys who, you know, have the beards and mustaches of like a previous century still hanging around, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. To talk about today, you know, today's Supreme Court, from a libertarian perspective, from a kind of pro-liberty, you know, individual liberty perspective, how would you rate this, you know, current court?
Good on some, bad on others, I would say. Very, very strong on free speech generally.
Is there an easy explanation for that? Because, I mean, it's really remarkable. And this is one of the places where it seems to me the Supreme Court is a real bulwark of liberty, because states and, you know, and the federal government are obviously willing to curtail speech and expression, you know, at the drop of a hat. And it's the Supreme Court that seems to be saying, no, you really can't do that.
Yeah, none of this is written in stone. We've had Supreme Courts that were very bad on speech and upheld, you know, terrible laws during, you know, World War I or something like that. So, but that's I would say is a bright spot. You know, the one of the sort of libertarian hopes is always that there's going to be more of a reception for some of the arguments about unenumerated rights, the Ninth Amendment, maybe the Privileges or Immunities Clause will kind of come roaring back. Mm-hmm. We'll get the slaughterhouse cases overturned, and that's still a pretty much a long shot.
How about this current court's term, or, you know, its decisions on executive power? Are you feeling good or bad about that?
I mean, ask me again, and, you know, after the birthright citizenship case, maybe. Well, the tariffs case as an executive power case, I mean, that was, I was happy with that outcome. That it was 6-3 is
a little bit worrying.
Well, I was quite disappointed in Justice Thomas's dissent, because he made this argument that, because, you know, one of the questions in that case was that, did Trump have the either inherent or somehow, you know, delegated by Congress authority to just sort of unilaterally enact all of these tariffs. And one of the questions that's kind of lurking in the background is something called the non-delegation doctrine, which is the separation of powers issue. If Congress is going to delegate its authority to the executive branch, it's got to do what does it require? It's got to be super clear. Maybe there's some things it can never delegate or something like that. And, you know, Thomas said, well, you know, these kind of powers kind of are inherited. You know, they're kind of kingly powers. You know, and so the non-delegation doctrine just sort of shouldn't apply at all. You know, Congress could actually basically hand over the war-making powers, even though it's in the Constitution, it's given to Congress, it's not given to the president. The founders made that choice when they drafted the document. And I was quite surprised at that. That's an embrace of, I mean, that's not even the unitary executive. That's just this kind of very sweeping presidential power.
Is Thomas disappointing to you? You've written a lot about him, and generally in a positive direction.
It depends on the issue.
Does he seem to be getting less robust in his I don't, you know, I just say like defense of liberty is too vague, but
I think it probably has to do with the issues that are before the court. Mm-hmm. So on kind of the Kelo property rights kind of side, you know, he was somebody that libertarians were really cheering for in those cases. But he's always been someone who's very law and order conservative, you might say. You know, him and Justice Scalia would have these incredible headbutting over in Fourth Amendment cases where, there was this Thomas opinion that Scalia called a freedom destroying cocktail, mm-hmm. Or things like that, where Thomas has never been on the kind of libertarian side on those issues. And so then executive power, he's not someone who takes any kind of, constrained view of what the president can do.
Imagine if Gary Johnson had become president, maybe he would be singing a different tune.
Maybe.
Well, let's talk about the birthright citizenship case. Make a prediction. Is birthright citizenship going to be upheld, or do you think it'll be struck down?
Trump himself seems to think he's going to lose.
Yeah.
He said that several times.
Well, he thought that in 2016.
Yeah, indeed. Right? Indeed. Yeah. I mean, he attended the oral arguments, or the first half himself.
Is that the only time like the president
the
has...
only recorded presidential visit to a Supreme Court oral argument?
That's like a real Tony Soprano kind of.
Well, I think he was hoping it was going to be, and he seems to be upset that, and he's even complained that it wasn't acknowledged. I guess the justices didn't bow or something.
Him a tip or something,
whatever
prize. Yeah.
He came out of there, I think, with the correct view of how the oral arguments went, which was that quite a few justices asked the kind of questions or made the kind of comments mm-hmm. that if that's the way they're thinking, that's fatal to his position. So that seems to be how it's mm-hmm. going to play out. You never
and
know.
Is that why is that a good thing if voluntary birth, birthright is upheld?
Well, if you care about the text and history and original meaning of the 14th Amendment, mm-hmm. that's the correct result.
Yeah.
That Trump's executive order is unlawful. That's so. And if most conservatives and Trump and his Supreme Court justices all purport to be originalists, so that's the Trump losing is the originalist result in this case. If you don't care about that, if you're thinking about just sort of the policy implications of it, then maybe you don't like it as a policy mm-hmm. because of, the birth tourism or whatever.
Yeah.
But those are not legal. Those are not legal questions. Or you might call that a living constitutionalist kind of say, well, they couldn't imagine something like this happening, so therefore it's got to be wrong now. So that's what I would say to
I'm the child of two anchor babies, so I'm kind of glad that my parents were citizens because they were born to people who were not citizens.
Right.
So, it's kind of worked out for me. But I think we're going to leave it there. The book is Emancipation War, The Fall of Slavery and the Coming of the 13th Amendment. And the author is Reason's Damon Root. Damon, thanks for talking.
Thanks, Nick.